Trigrupam arkam vapura trivrandre. Parasparam siddhitiya svatake. Atma yadesham aparo yad ajaha. Svayanubhuyatkila siddha siddhi. Trigrupamarkam vapur atrirandre. Parasparam siddhiti yaksvatake. Atma yadesham aparo yadadya. Svayanubhuyatkila siddha siddhi. Trigrupamarkam vapura trirandre. Parasparam siddhiti yaksvatake. Atma yadesham aparo yadya. Svayanubhutyakila siddha siddhi. Vaishnavis. Drick, the function of sight as adhyatma. Rupam, visible form as adibhuta. Arkam, of the sun. Vapu, the partial image as adidaiva. Atra, in this. Rundre, aperture of the eyeball. Parasparam, mutually, siddhiti, cause the manifestation of each other. Ya, which, svata, by its own power, ke, in the sky, atma, the supersoul, yat, which, asham, of these three features, apara, separate. Ya, who, adya, the original cause, svaya, by his own, anubhutya, transcendental experience, akila, of all, siddha, manifest phenomena, siddhi, the source of manifestation. Translation purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Sight, visible form, and the reflected image of the sun within the aperture of the eye all work together to reveal one another. But the original sun standing in the sky is self-manifested. Similarly, the Supreme Soul, the original cause of all causes, who is thus separate from all of them, acts by the illumination of his own transcendental experience as the ultimate source of manifestation of all mutually manifesting objects. Another very simple verse here. Okay. Purport. Form is recognized by the function of the eye, and the eye's function is understood by the presence of perceivable form. This interaction of sight and form further depends on the presence of light provided by the demigods, whose service of universal management depends on the presence of those who are to be managed, namely the living entities experiencing form with their eyes. Thus the three factors, adhyatma, represented by the senses such as the eye, adibhuta, the sense object such as form, and adidaiva, the influence of the controlling deities, exist in an interdependent relationship. The sun globe itself is said to be self-manifest, self-luminous, and self-experiencing. It does not share the interdependence of the senses and sense objects, although facilitating their functions. Similarly, the Supreme Personality of Godhead facilitates the interdependent experiences of all living entities. For example, newspapers, radio, and television reveal world events to the mass of people. Parents reveal facts about life to their children, teachers to their students, friends to friends, and so on. The government manifests its will to the people and the people to their government. The sun and moon reveal the visual forms of all objects, and the perception of sound reveals audible form. The vibrations of particular types of music or rhetoric reveal the inner feelings of other living beings, and other types of knowledge are revealed by aroma, touch, and taste. In this way, through the interaction of the senses and mind with innumerable sense objects, different types of knowledge are acquired. All such informative interactions, however, depend upon the supreme illuminating power of the Personality of Godhead. Is stated in Brahma Samhita 552, Yach Chakshu Esha Savita Sakala Grahanam. Among all the planets, the sun is considered the eye of the Supreme Lord. The Personality of Godhead is eternally omniscient by his own transcendental potencies, and thus no one can reveal anything to the Lord about anything. Still, Lord Krishna humbly accepts our prayers offered in Krishna consciousness. In conclusion, Lord Krishna clearly explains here that his sublime characteristics are completely different from those of the manifest universe. The Lord is therefore the supreme transcendental entity, free from all material influence. Om Gyana Timurandisha Gyananjana Salakaya Chakshu Nitamina Tasmai Sri Gavena Maha Vanchako Patrivishcha Kripa Sindhu Vivicha Patikano Pavane Bhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. Hare Krishna. So, I probably should start with a little background. It's hard to completely understand these verses without some context. Of course, Trivikram Prabhu did a really nice job yesterday of giving some background, explaining how all this fits together and where this fits into the discussion. So, it might be a little repetitive from yesterday, but I think it's good just to try to understand exactly what's being discussed here. So, in this portion of this chapter, we started with about verse 26, where Uddhava is saying, is clearly understanding that the Lord and Prakriti, the material energy, are distinct. One is conscious and one is not conscious. Prakriti is unconscious. Obviously, the Lord is fully conscious, the supreme consciousness. But yet they appear mutually dependent. And it's described that Krishna is in the body and the body is part of the Lord, because obviously nothing can be apart from him. So in other words, there is an interaction. And how do you sort of separate those things? There's also an intermingling of consciousness in the body. That's another thing that's being described here. So because of this intermingling of the consciousness in the body, It leads to a misperception of the distinction between the soul, the jiva, and the body. So that's all kind of being described here. And Krishna will now discuss these issues and dispel these misunderstandings. So it might seem apparent that, well, of course, there's a soul within the body, but the soul is different than the body. But what's being pointed out here is by these more complex interactions, it can become confusing, and it can appear that there's a very close connection. Because after all, we're talking about this idea of perception, through our senses, we are perceiving through our eyes, in light, we are perceiving objects. So who is perceiving? Who is aware? Who is conscious? Obviously, that's the soul. Without the presence of the jiva, the atma within the body, there would be no awareness or perception of sense objects, right? So there is an interaction. It doesn't mean that the soul is the body, but it's interacting. I was trying to think of an example of this. I don't know if this is a good example or not. It's kind of like if the police are dealing with criminals, there's an interaction, there's a relationship. But the policeman goes home at night, he's not part of the criminal. He's not a criminal. But he's associating with those people for different reasons. I don't know if that's a good example or not. But at any rate, so the soul is within this body, connected with the body in terms of, of its position. And therefore, its consciousness and our consciousness and awareness utilizes the senses, the sense object, the object of the senses, by the help of the demigods, all of these things are going on. So it's important that we have a good understanding of these things and how they interact so that we can, through our intelligence, understand the difference between the spirit soul and the body and mind. So where we are right now is this idea of the difference between the Purusha and the Prakriti. The Purusha Krishna is clearly distinct from his energy. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur points out that there's four verses, verses 29 through 33, that explore this idea. First, the understanding that there is a difference between Krishna as Purusha and Krishna's energy as Prakriti or material nature. So there's four things here. Prakriti undergoes change. It takes various forms. It is dependent upon Krishna. It is, obviously manifest from Krishna, and it is revealed by processes of the three aspects that we're discussing today, the Adiyatmika, Adi Bhutika, and Adi Daivik. On the other hand, Krishna, the Lord, does not change. He's not subject to the three modes of nature. He has one form, although we know he can manifest many forms as he wants. He's independent, and as described in this verse today, he is self-revealing. He's the source of manifestation, mutually manifesting objects, and he illuminates by his own transcendental experience. So it's quite a distinction here between Krishna and his energy. And that's what Uddhava is trying to explore and wants Krishna to further reveal. Although, because sometimes it seems as though they're very intertwined and intermingled, and to make the clarity of that distinction. So now we're talking about how the material energies work within our bodies. And we're talking about the nature of the differences in Prakriti and the perception of those differences. So there's an explanation of interconnection of material energy in the jiva. So first that's discussed, and then later the distinction, especially later in the chapter, much more clearly the distinctions are made between the jiva and Prakriti and Krishna and Prakriti. So why are we discussing this? Okay. Because the interaction between consciousness in the jiva and the experiences of created by the material energy are very close and intertwined. And therefore, we need to understand these things and through our intelligence separate what is matter and what is spirit. That's actually, Prabhupada said, that is what is the purpose of intelligence, right? To distinguish matter from spirit. And that's and so an intelligent person, informed by the scriptures and by acharyas, is able to do this and thus understand real spiritual life. So what's been described here is the material transformations are perceived in three aspects: the adiyatmik, adibuddhik, and adidaivik. It's interesting. I was trying to think, well, what are these actually? Are they energies? The word energy isn't exactly used. Aspect is used, and words like that.
Factors,
aspects like that. Yeah, so sometimes we energy seems to be very much more of a distinct categorization, you know, like, in other words, energies are manifested in different ways, or there's, you know, Krishna manifests, you know, Kladini, you know, et cetera, like that. So this isn't, it seems like it's not exactly like three energies, but three factors or three aspects. So the adiatmic is represented by the senses, such as here we're talking about the eye. And so that's the senses within the individual. Adiatmic atma refers to self. And of course, we know the word atma has many definitions, right? It can mean the spirit soul, but it can also mean the self, the body. I mean, it depends upon how it's used in context, from my understanding. Then there's adibuddhik, which is the sense objects, such as form, what we're actually perceiving. And then the adidaivik is the influence of the controlling deities. In this case, it'd be light, like light from the sun or light from... In other words, to see an object, if I'm experiencing sight, first of all, there has to be my own senses. There has to be the eyes and the sense of sight. Then there has to be a sense object. That's the adibodhik, the other person, the other thing. And then there has to be light, right? And that's under the control of the demigods or the daivas. So that's the adidaiva. So those three things are acting in that sort of intermingling, interactive way. And this is a concept that's there in many places. I was looking for some sources. And Srimad Bhagavatam, for example, 2.10.8 says, the individual person possessing different instruments of senses is called the adhyatmic person. The individual controlling deity of the senses is called adidaivik. The embodiment seen on the eyeballs is called the adibodhik person. So this was discussed much earlier in the Bhagavatam. Now, of course, as Krishna is sort of giving the whole full synopsis here in the Uddhava Gita of all the different philosophical elements which is being discussed again. Now, it's also mentioned that, of course, this is a contrast. The first contrast is given is with the sun, because the sun is self-illuminating. Obviously, it's the source of light, so it doesn't require anything outside of itself to produce that. And I was thinking, well, what about the demigods? Well, it's often Surya is, right, the demigod controlling the sun. The sun is sort of his, you could say, his body, in a sense, or his embodiment. So the sun, in that sense, is quite self-sufficient. Now, of course, even more so, that was a material analogy, but even more so is the position of the Supreme Lord Krishna, who is totally independent. He has no need of anything outside. In fact, he is the creator and controller of all of these material elements and all of these different aspects. And it's described here that he's self-illuminating and he is controlling Prakriti and the living entities. I was thinking about this adiatmic, adidaivik, and adibodhik, and this is, of course, sort of a technical understanding of it, but we usually see it in a different context, don't we? Prabhupada often talks about adidaivik, adibodhik, and adiatmic as the threefold miseries. So this is often the way that we think of these, and I was trying to think, well, what's the connection here between this and that? Well, if you look at it, adiatmaka refers to the senses. We're talking about the eyes or the senses. We can say the senses or the body of the individual. Now, is that a source of misery? Absolutely. We get diseases, we get injured, and then there's mental distress. Prabhupada often talks about this in several purports and letters in different places. Physical and mental distress are there as adiatmic miseries because they're based upon the senses, the body, the mind. And then as far as adibodhik, which is the object or other living entities, we experience all sorts of difficulties in other living entities, don't we? Isn't that one of the most difficult things for us, our relationships with others? There's some mental distress caused by others, and then we feel insulted by another person. We, you know, there's so many things that cause us unhappiness. And then extend that in a much greater way to wars or, you know, real violence that one living entity causes to another. I was reading somewhere that in the last century, in the 20th century, there were over 200 million people were killed by wars during that century. So certainly an adibodhik misery. So these things are there, and that's why we often look at these aspects of material energy, not just in a technical sense that, oh, these are interesting, the way that they're interacting, but it's actually when we identify with those, when we see those as reality, they cause great suffering and misery to the living entity. Another way this is, in this aspect of these, it's there's also scriptural references in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Anchalila 5.127. This is spoken by Sri Damodar. He says, "The conditioned soul, however, is always covered by ignorance and embarrassed by the threefold miseries of life. Thus, he is a treasure house of all kinds of tribulations." Again, we see how these three aspects are considered to be great sources of misery and tribulation mentioned here. So we need to have a clear understanding of these interactions and how they will affect us. And here's a letter from Srila Prabhupada in 1968 where he talks about how important it is for us to convey this understanding to people. He says, "Our mission is that people should understand their relationship with Krishna and thus let him become Krishna conscious so he may be relieved from the threefold miseries of material existence." So the great mercy, of course, of the Vaishnavas is that they understand the misery, the suffering of living entities that are caused by these threefold aspects of material nature. And therefore, our mission is to help people understand that they are not these miseries. This is something separate from them, but they are eternal servants of Krishna, and have that relationship with Krishna will relieve them from their suffering condition. So that understanding of the position of the jiva is very, very critical. Otherwise, billions and billions of living entities will continue to suffer in this material world. One of the most, of course, instructive places, very well-known place of spiritual instruction comes from Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in Majjhalila in the 20th chapter, and that's, of course, his instructions to Sanatana Goswami. And the very beginning of those instructions, the first few verses, you know, practically give us our whole philosophy. It's all contained there. The very first verse, when, was it 108? Is it 108? When he starts speaking to Sanatana Goswami, he says, "Jivarasa Rupaya Krishnara Nichidas Krishnara Tatashta Shanti Beta Beta Prakash." So Lord Chaitanya first describes the jiva as Krishnara Nichidas, the eternal servant of Krishna. That's her eternal position. But he's also Tatashta Shakti, marginal. Therefore, a tendency to become covered and identify with matter, with the material energy, with the material body. And he says, beta, beta, prakash. So he says that the living entity is simultaneously one and different from Krishna. Right? It's kind of like the whole philosophy contained in that verse. We're eternal servants of Krishna, but we are one and different from Krishna, and because the difference is that we are marginal and we can become covered by material energy. So then a few verses later, after establishing the real identity of the jiva, Krishnara, Nichidas, Lord Chaitanya says, "Forgetting Krishna, the living entity has been attracted by the external feature from time immemorial. Therefore, the illusory energy, Maya, gives him all kinds of misery in his material existence, samsara dukkha." So, here we are, in this material world, identifying with matter, suffering the material world. Of course, everything we experience is there in purity in the spiritual world. And the Bhagavad Gita describes, like in the 15th chapter, the banyan tree with its roots upward and branches downward. And this material world is like that reflection in the water. So we cannot see the reality. We are seeing the reflection and thinking the reflection is the real thing and not the actual tree, spiritual knowledge. Bhagavad Gita 3.27 says, "The spirit soul, bewildered by the influence of false ego," false identification with the body, "thinks himself the doers of activities that are actuality carried out by the three modes of material nature." So our conditioned nature is conditioned by the three modes of nature. We are under their control, not under the control of Krishna, not under the control of the real free freedom of the spirit soul.
when we are in relationship with Krishna. And thus, what do we experience in this material world? Karshati, the hard struggle for material existence. 15.7, the living entity and its conditioned worlds are my eternal fragmental parts. Due to conditioned life, they're struggling very hard with the six senses, which include the mind. So these adhyatmic aspects, like this, the six senses and the mind, these are the aspects of the self, of the body, that are going to cause unhappiness and suffering to the living entities. Srila Prabhupada says in the purport to that verse 15.7, the living entity in his liberated state is free from material condition, and he is under the engagement of the transcendental service of the Lord. In conditioned life, he's dominated by the material modes of nature, and he forgets the transcendental loving service of the Lord. As a result, he has to struggle very hard to maintain his existence in the material world. So what is the relationship between Krishna, Jiva, and the material energy? That's really the discussion of this part of the Bhagavatam. And it's explained in a more complex technical way here, but we can also understand it fairly simply. In the Bhagavad Gita introduction, the Lord refers to this, this is Prabhupada speaking, my prakriti. This material nature is the separated energy of the Supreme Lord, and similarly the living entities are also the energy of the Supreme Lord, although they are not separated, but eternally related. So the Lord, the living entity, the material nature, and time are all interrelated and all eternal. So this eternal relationship and interrelationship is always there with the living entity, material nature, and Krishna. So, of course, Krishna says in 7.14 of Bhagavad Gita, Daivahesha, Punamayi, Amamaya. The divine energy of mind consisting of these three modes of material nature. So prakriti is Krishna's energy. It is part of him, and he is also separate from him. Because Krishna simultaneously creates and enters the material world, and yet he remains aloof. And that's our philosophical concept of Achinta Beta Veda Tattva. That's part of it. It's a complex concept, and it can be applied in different ways. But one way that, of course, is applied is that Krishna is both the same as the material world and different. The same in the sense that he creates it, maintains it, annihilates it, is in charge of it, makes it all work, everything happens under his direction. But different in that it is not him. He does not become the material energy. He doesn't absorb himself. He doesn't lose his true spiritual identity. He remains separate as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, playing in Vrindavan while all this material world is going on. So his energies, of course, are non-different. They have full potencies, and yet he is apart from his energies and does not become lessened by them. So Krishna says in the 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, by me and my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. And yet everything is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence, etc. So it's very clearly explained there. And this is a further confirmation of the verse we're talking about today, that Krishna is the cause of all living entities, and yet he is separate and acts by, as was stated here, the illumination of all mutually manifesting objects, which is a hard one to put your mind around. Right? Now further, after Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, then he confirms his supreme control, mayada kshena prakriti, Suyate Satcharacharam. This material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, O Son of Kunti, producing all moving and non-moving beings. Under its rule, this manifestation is created and annihilated again and again. So he simultaneously enters the world, yet remains separate and aloof, and he pervades everything through his energies. So you might say, well, how is Krishna aloof, yet he's everywhere, and yet it's through his energies. It's through the manifestation and transformation of his energies that Krishna creates everything and controls everything, although remaining separate as the Supreme Person, Krishna. So, And why this is important to us, we need to understand how the material nature works. And we need to be able to get out of this material nature. In a letter in 1974, Srila Prabhupada said, "Every one of us is suffering from the threefold miseries of material existence. Coming to the platform of bhakti, pure devotional service, one immediately ceases the blazing fire of material existence. That is the effect of Sri Krishna's sankirtan. The whole world is in a chaotic condition without understanding this philosophy." So, as in this example, Srila Prabhupada always preached strongly on these basic points. He told us repeatedly that this material world was a place of suffering, and that suffering was caused by the misidentification of the self with the body and the mind. Because we are looking at all of these interactions of senses and sense objects, the soul becomes overwhelmed and through false ego thinks that it is the body and mind and intelligence, and therefore becomes not only illusion be bad enough, not knowing who we really are, but suffers because of this misidentification. So we need to understand our spiritual nature, because that is the way of relief of suffering. The way of the relief of suffering of the threefold miseries is by understanding that we are not these things, but we are the Atman, the soul, the jiva, within the body. And that soul has an eternal loving relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead as his servant. And that's very freeing for the living entity. Because in the spiritual world, there is no suffering. So there may be some suffering as part of a pastime to increase love of Krishna. But there's no material suffering as we experience it. And that's what everybody wants. People are looking at how to be happy and how to be relieved from the pain and the suffering of their experience. Now, some people might say, well, I'm not suffering. I'm feeling pretty good. That means they're probably under 30 years old and, you know, everything's going well for them. You know, but the sufferings will be there. And often people are in some denial or some illusion about, you know, that everything is great, I'm not suffering. But birth, death, disease, and old age will always be there. So every living entity will experience this. Every living entity will experience the threefold miseries. Therefore, we need to be able to understand how these things are working and how they work and interact so closely with the self, with the Atma, that they can overwhelm the intelligence of the living entity and cause us to identify with those things. Therefore, we need to understand how this works, understand our spiritual nature, our relationship with Krishna. And as Prabhupada said, this comes about by the effect of Sri Krishna Sankirtan. Through the Sankirtan movement, through the chanting of Hare Krishna, one develops this understanding. Of course, one has to hear from the spiritual master, hear from the scriptures, but many people can hear or read and not fully understand. So one also needs service. And the best service, the most effective and powerful service in this age of Kali is the chanting of the holy name. So in that way, through chanting Hare Krishna, hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, we can come to this clear understanding. Okay, I'll stop at that point. Thoughts, questions, comments? Maharaj?
Hare Krishna. Thank you for unpacking a little bit what we heard and explaining it in terms that are more familiar to us in general, and connecting it with our core philosophical principles. We can go in different directions. You had mentioned one thing was that the that Krishna is different from his material energies, but then later you acknowledge that Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva, so he's also one. There's a maybe Sri Govinda Prabhu knows the source of that Shakti, Shakti Mayor Abedam, from some Vedic aphorism. That emphasizes Abedam. It says that actually Krishna is non-different from his energies. I would, and I'm a little bit obsessed with this verse that I found so stimulating in Krishna consciousness and maybe intellectually, that I mentioned the other day, that Krishna says to Uddhava later in the 11th canto, that anything which is revealed and is caused by something else is actually only that other thing. And that is my opinion. So, of course, Krishna's opinion is the final opinion. You see, he's pointing out that anything that did not exist in the past will not exist in the future. In the present, has no real existence of its own. So it doesn't mean we're not going to say everything is false. Because it has existence, but it doesn't have its own existence. Its existence is based on what's underlying it, what's causing it. And then you go back and back and back, and then you get to the cause of all causes. I had mentioned this a few weeks ago, a few months ago now, I guess. So, the other option is to actually appreciate, we talk about yukta vairagya, to actually appreciate Krishna's immanence in addition to his transcendence. I think the technical term is panentheism, that Krishna is both transcendent, he's also immanent. He's different, he's transcendent, but at least in his Brahman Paramatma features, he's also one. And then looking at it from the point of view of the external energy and everything that we see, and the ultimate issue, any existence that it has is actually Krishna. So that's why Krishna says in 7.12, in one sense, I'm everything. So, I'm sorry I'm sort of digressing into different points, but I hope it has some relevance to today's class.
No, that was very good. I really appreciated that. I think I was thinking about your first point about that things do not have an independent existence. You know, that they're, and I guess that also relates to the fact that everything, you know, the material, anything in the material energy is considered temporary. You know, Prabhupada often explained it's real, but it's temporary. In other words, it's a coming together of material elements. They come together for some time, then they'll dissolve, and then that thing that we have there, that object, will no longer exist at a certain point. But what does remain, but there are eternal elements as well, right? Prakriti is considered eternal because it's an eternal expansion of Krishna's energy. So in other words, the underlying aspects are eternal, I think you were saying, although that particular manifestation, especially of material energy, may be temporary. Is that close to what you were saying?
Yeah, well, when we talk about phenomena and how the energy manifests, those things are temporary. There's one thing that's very interesting to keep in mind, is that we normally hear, I mean, Prabhupada said we should read his book, Scrutinizing. So, if Srila Prabhupada, the default mode is we hear that the material world is real, but it's temporary. But then in the philosophical discussions, I think with Shamashundra, Shamashundra tried to repeat that oh, it is real, but it's temporary. And Prabhupada said, if it's temporary, how can it be real? So
in the deepest sense of real, meaning
yeah, I mean, so eternal reality. Prabhupada would normally take in terms of phenomena, in terms of the world that we live in, we're not going to deny that there's something going on there. And, of course, we can use it in Krishna's service, and that really makes it real. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if we take the rigorous definition given in 2.16 in Bhagavad Gita, then we do find it's an oxymoron to attribute actual reality to something which didn't exist in the past, which is not going to exist in the future, and has only an illusory existence at present. So Srila Prabhupada would work on both levels of defining what is real.
Yeah, and that very temporary aspect includes our material bodies, which we think are very real, you know, and are so attached to. But as you said, they're in one sense, you can say they're also not real because it's a temporary manifestation. Yeah.
We don't say everything is God.
We don't say what?
We don't say everything is God.
Right.
God is distinct from everything.
Yep.
He creates and he controls. And there is an eternal relationship God has with everything. The thread that runs through everything in that relationship, one can inquire the presence of God in everything because there is a relationship. And Krishna also in Bhagavad Gita claimed that matta paratarana annat kinchit asti dhananjayam sutri mani gana iva, that the thread that runs through everything. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes that actually everybody should inquire the presence of God in everything because he has a relationship with everything. Because if we say everything is God, then it will be pantheism. We accept monotheism, not pantheism. We actually, Prabhupada, the conversation with Vedanta Maharaj and Guru Prabhu, their discussion was that polymorphic bimonotheism is what Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy, which is above monotheism, above monoism, all ism actually included in that, but polymorphic bimonotheism is complete what Krishna consciousness supersede any other philosophy's conception of God.
Well, doesn't Krishna state all this pretty clearly? I'm going back to the ninth chapter where he says, by me and my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. Yet everything is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence. Although I'm the maintainer of all living entities, and although I'm everywhere, I am not a part of this cosmic manifestation. For myself is the very source of creation. Madanjaya, all this work cannot bind me. I am ever detached from all material activities, seated as though neutral. So, yeah, this soul, Chintaveda Veda, that, but Krishna's, you know, Krishna's actually is right there in Bhagavad Gita. That's great.
But then somebody might put a question. The Dhruva Maharaja's case in Bhagavatam, we see very exceptional case that we are saying, okay, we are not the body, we are the servant of Krishna's soul, conscious being, unit of consciousness, distinct from the material elements. But in Dhruva Maharaja's case, he did not give up this material body. His material body transformed into his spiritual body. And this is one of the, not controversy, one of the mystical that Krishna how transformed as he wish.
Sure, why can't Krishna do that?
Yeah.
Krishna can transform material to spiritual.
Sorry, what was the question someone proposed?
Being it distinct from the material elements. The body is material elements. So we are not the body in that sense that we are not a product of material elements. We are unit of consciousness, belongs to Krishna. Krishna is the full conscious being. We are also unit of consciousness. But in Dhruva Maharaja's case, his body turned into himself. The soul and body, I don't know how it happened. It's very... mystical.
Wasn't there something similar with Yudhishthira Maharaj, or am I imagining that?
Who?
Yudhishthira.
No. He did that, but he dissolved all the elements,
yeah,
and he entered into through meditation.
Okay, so all the material elements.
All the Pandavas.
Okay, I was thinking some. Yeah. Okay. Okay, one more. Let's get another. Is anyone, by the way, any other questions, comments? Let's try to get everybody involved. Let's go over to the ladies' side, Ragatmika, and back to Yamaraj, then we'll return.
that's the point made that God is not everything. But at the same time, actually Srila Prabhupada said in a lecture we heard two Sundays ago, he said, when you see everything as Krishna's mercy, you will go back to Godhead. So, on one hand, someone may take that, okay, just kind of lay around like a python, no, and whatever happens is Krishna's mercy, and not tend to one's responsibilities or on the material plane, or what to speak of spiritual endeavors. So, do you have anything to balance that?
We make spiritual advancement by following the instructions of the guru.
Mm-hmm.
And Srila Prabhupada's instructions, those are very clear, not to lay next to the Mahaprasadam table, you know, and waiting for something to drop and help us, but to actively serve. As Yukta Vairagya was mentioned, use the material elements, use everything that's here in active service, offering everything to Krishna, offering our body, mind, and words to Krishna. I mean, that's our process. And in other words, we can't be Jada Bharat or something like that, or some of the other examples, Avadutas. It really doesn't work for us, especially in Kali Yuga. And some of the devotees who even attempted such a thing, wasn't there a devotee in Mayapur who wanted to sit in a tree and chant all day? And Prabhupada was not impressed. He did not like that. He was much more happy and enthusiastic when his devotees went out and actively preached and, you know, imitating Hare Das Thakur, yeah. And we don't... In other words, some of the acharyas and great devotees are there. We understand their example, but it doesn't mean we necessarily imitate. So, we follow Prabhupada's instructions. Yamaraj, Guru?
Okay, thanks for your class. I was reading the translation there, the Supreme Soul, the original cause of all entities, who is thus separate from all of them, acts by the illumination of his own transcendental experience as the ultimate source of manifestation of all mutually manifesting objects. So my question is, okay, so we have free will in the material nature only, or once we become Krishna consciousness, Krishna conscious, we're surrendering our free will to Krishna's will.
Yes and no. We actually have less free. We have less manifest. We always have free will. That's part of the eternal nature of the living entity. And I gave a couple classes on that, actually, on free will. I don't have all that material right handy with me, but there's a lot of quotes from Prabhupada and scriptures that indicate that the free will is always there. Otherwise, there can't be loving relationships with Krishna and the living entity without free will. We surrender our free will, in a sense, to Krishna's will, because by our free will, we want to please Krishna and do whatever is his will. But we can rescind that, which apparently we did, and here we are in the material world, by misuse of free will. So the ability to exercise free will is there with living entity, as far as I understand. Do we willingly give up some of that? Of course, in the material, you just mentioned the material world, mostly that's illusion of free will. Mostly we're under the modes of nature, but yet there is free will. We obviously make choices that create karma, that we obtain our next body based upon those, so there are choices the living entity makes. You know, so free will is always there. But there's one really nice purport, I don't have it with me, where Prabhupada explains how it is this sort of the glorious position of the freedom of living entity. He gives the example, she's talking about Narada Muni in one purport. I don't know if I can find it. But and talks about how Narada Muni, as a pure devotee of Krishna, is completely free to go everywhere and anywhere in the universe. And he explains how that freedom is there when one is fully surrendered to Krishna. So it's one of those sort of, what do you call it? What's the word when something seems contradictory? not an oxymoron. Paradox, something like that. Yeah, paradox is good. Or something like that. In other words, where you would think that surrendering means you're giving up freedom and you no longer have free will. But actually, by full surrender to Krishna, the free will of the living entity is most fully manifest. Because what we really want, a real will, is to be in that eternal relationship with Krishna, loving relationship. What is the main, what?
The main distinct between the matter and the consciousness is free will. So you said it's very perfect that free will is eternal.
Yes, but matter is not conscious, and therefore it doesn't have volition, it doesn't have will. I gave a class a few months ago based on the Paramahamsa Siddhartha of Jiva Goswami. It's really interesting because it's about Paramatma, but the first half of it's really about the Atma, about the nature of the soul. And he talks about how the soul has consciousness, has self-awareness, is fully self-illuminated, you know, has volition. In other words, has free will, is an actor, is a doer. So, you know, we think of the soul just being, because right now we're so covered over, it's hard to even imagine, you know, the soul and its full activity and its full manifestation. But once we, you know, get rid of these layers through a false ego and the sense in the body, then, you know, it's this wonderful spirit soul emerges.
I was thinking, Prabhupada, giving that example of Bhagavad Gita, that Arjuna was apparently in ignorance. But after Arjuna was completely liberated, Krishna still gave him a choice. Jata ichchasi tata kuru. Do as you wish. So that means that even in the pure, Prabhupada made that point, that even in the ultimate sense, the free will or free choice is still always there.
You remember a few months ago we had a little discussion with one speaker about the nature of free will, and there was some disagreement amongst many people in the audience, and that speaker was saying there was no free will. And one of the points I think you made, Pran, was that we see in some of the pastimes of Krishna, like with the gopis and like that, and other of his most intimate devotees, it's almost like Krishna gives up his free will for the will of his devotees. Yes. And he says, I am your servant. So it's not like, you know, we surrender to Krishna and it's this dictatorship or something, you know. Some, you know, like people might think, you know, I don't want to give up. I don't want to surrender. Surrender, you know, usually is a very negative connotation. But fortunately, God is this very loving, wonderful, supreme person, you know, that there's this wonderful interaction. And if there wasn't some of that free will, how could there be those loving relationships and, you know, that Krishna so much enjoys? No, if nothing else, for Krishna's own enjoyment, he wants the free will of the living entity to be there.
That's the 9.4.64.
What is it?
Ninth canto Bhagavatam, ninth canto, fourth chapter, 64, where Krishna says, Aham bhakta paradhina, hi shatantra ivaddija, sadhava grasta ridaya bhaktir bhakta janapriya. Even though in my constitutional position, I am fully independent, but by my nature, I am always subordinate to the will of the devotee.
Yeah,
I take the subordinate position.
That's a wonderful verse. 9.4, what is it?
9.4.63.64.
Okay, I think we're out of time. Past time. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.